Good morning, this is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, August 4th, 2012. I do not have a guest today. Instead, I'm going to talk about a book called Onward Christian Soldiers, An American Journalist's Dissident Look at World War II. It was written initially in 1944 by Donald Day. Recently, in 1984, Noontide Press published it again. And I have a copy that was actually published in 1981. Donald Day was born on May 15, 1895 in Brooklyn, New York. In 1917, Day became a pilot in the U.S. Navy, and after World War I, he returned to New York and worked as a sports reporter for the Morning Telegraph. He later became the editor of the New York World. In 1921, Ludwig Martens, a Soviet representative in New York, invited Day to accompany him on his deportation from the U.S. to the Soviet Union, where Day could report on news events. Day obtained a Soviet visa in Riga, Latvia. Floyd Gibbons, the European director of the Chicago Tribune, offered Day the job of the newspaper's Northern European correspondent, which Day accepted. Beginning in August 1921, he was the only U.S. reporter in the region and reported on events in the Baltic states, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Soviets withdrew his visa when he refused to favorably report on the Soviet system. He also wanted to accurately report on the communist subversion of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Because he had no direct access, he relied on reports from refugees and his own correspondents who he had sent across the Soviet border. He was a committed anti-communist and reflected this attitude in his newspaper reports, especially those regarding the compulsory collectivization of agriculture in the 1920s and the deliberate Soviet famine of 1932-1933. 3 months before Election Day in 1936, the Chicago Tribune headlined a story from Donald Day, and the headline read, "Moscow orders Reds in the U.S. to back Roosevelt." The Chicago Times, a competitive newspaper, promptly offered $5,000 for proof that the story was true. The Tribune printed a full-page ad claiming the truthfulness of the story, but they never collected the $5,000. Day was unlike most other Western reporters in his uncompromising reports on the Soviet Union. In March 1939, Polish authorities prohibited Day from releasing reports about the ongoing persecution of the country's ethnic German minority. During the same period, Day was a war correspondent in the Finnish-Soviet Winter War of 1939-1940. In July 1940, when the Soviets invaded Latvia, officials gave Day 24 hours to leave the country. In his report, he stated that the Russian and Jewish minorities in the country actually facilitated that invasion. He reported that on June 17th, the flag-waving mob at the railway station shouted in Russian or Yiddish, not in the Latvian language. After the USSR annexed the Baltic states, the Tribune relocated Day to Sweden to continue reporting as its Stockholm correspondent. Day accompanied Finnish troops in 1941 as they advanced into Soviet territory in the Continuation War of 1941 until 1944. Day's passport had expired, and he attempted unsuccessfully to renew it, but instead found himself technically as a stateless person. Towards the end of the war, Day felt that it was essential that reporters convince the West about the communist expansion into Eastern Europe behind the advancing Red Army. Day relocated to Berlin, where the German state radio employed him as a commentator. Day broadcasted to American forces in Europe from August 31, 1944 until April 1945. On August 31st, 1944, the Montreal Gazette, actually dated September 1st, 1944, wrote this article, and the headline is U.S. on Wrong Side, Says Berlin Radio. Broadcaster claims to be Donald Day, correspondent of the Chicago Tribune. And let me read this article. A speaker who identified himself as Donald Day, correspondent of the Chicago Tribune for 20 years in Northern Europe, declared in a broadcast from Berlin recorded by CBS monitors tonight that the United States was on the wrong side of the war. Just why am I speaking from Berlin can wait until another talk. For tonight, I want to tell you something about Finland, he said. And then he produces some excerpts. And I quote, the Finns are a nation of sportsmen, and they are continuing the war against Bolshevism in a sportsmanlike spirit. This is their last struggle for survival. The great majority of the Americans, like the Finns, are like the Finns. Finland is an obstacle to Roosevelt's ambitions and to his friend Stalin. She blocks Stalin's way to the ocean. Finland has not changed her policy or her form of government. She fought for her life in the Winter War of 1939 to 1940. She fights for her life today. There is something radically wrong in this world war lineup. Finland has not changed, but the American government has changed. So all of you who wanted to help Finland in the Winter War should realize that America is on the wrong side. Stalin stands for the destruction of Lithuania, Poland, Latvia, etc. Roosevelt's war aims are the same. The Roosevelt policy is the policy of J. Pierpont Morgan. In Chicago, a Tribune representative said the newspaper had a correspondent named Donald Day in northern European countries for approximately 20 years, and that he was discharged when he declined an order to return home when Finland went into the war on Germany's side. So that is what he was saying back in 1944, and he continued to broadcast until April 1945. Time magazine, dated Monday, September 18, 1944, reported that on September 6, the Chicago Tribune carried 10 hate stories against President Roosevelt and the administration, along with two stories about Sidney Hillman, the CIO, and PAC, but none against Hitler, the Nazis, or against Hirohito and the Japanese. Day believed that the Third Reich was the only safeguard against Soviet tyranny. He did not believe that the United States should have entered the war, and he maintained that Germany's cause against Russia was just. In his broadcast, he denounced President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Jewish instigators of atheistic communism, and America's military political alliance with the USSR. He believed justifiably that Germany, in fighting the Jewish Bolshevik regime of Russia, was performing a valiant service for Western civilization. In 1940, British officials added Day's name to their list of Nazis that they wanted to detain at the conclusion of the war. Counterintelligence Corps officials arrested Day in May 1945 and incarcerated him along with Mildred Gillers and Herbert John Bergman at Camp King, until they conditionally released him on December 24, 1946. Day then returned to his home, a single room in Bad Tölz, Bavaria. On January 12, 1949, officials arrested him again and charged him with treason, but the U.S. Justice Department soon dropped the case. On January 22, 1947, the Department of Justice issued a statement that it was not interested in prosecuting Day for his anti-Soviet broadcast during the war. In 1944, Day wrote the book that I'm talking about today. and it was published in Sweden in 1944. And Donald Day died of a heart attack on October 1st, 1966 in Helsinki, Finland. Okay, I'm going to share some selections from this book. I'm going to start with the foreword, the introduction. In his prime, Day was an imposing man, 6'2" tall and weighing 240 pounds. When he was in his late 20s and not long after he had settled in Europe, he married a white Russian emigre, whose first husband had been killed by the communists and whose baby had died of starvation in St. Petersburg during the Bolshevik famine in the winter of 1918-1919. Donald and Edith remained inseparable until his death. This is very interesting that he stayed in Europe. He never actually returned to the United States. As war approached in March-August 1939, Day lamented Britain's anti-German policies and the sharply anti-German tone of the British press, which he attributed to Jewish power and influence. In early 1939, the authorities in Warsaw barred him from verifying the rapidly accumulating reports of Polish persecutions of the country's ethnic German minority, which I already talked about, which was an important factor in the rising tension between Germany and Poland that culminated in the outbreak of war on September 1, 1939. All the same, he succeeded in interviewing German refugees who had fled Polish persecution and to report on their sufferings. In June and July of 1940, Day reported from Riga, Latvia, on the brutal Soviet subjugation of the Baltic lands. He was virtually the only Western reporter to provide frank, first-hand coverage of this great human tragedy. Similarly, he accompanied Finnish troops as they advanced into Soviet territory in the summer and fall of 1941. After the United States became directly involved in the great global conflict, Washington signaled its displeasure with Day, whose dispatches were not at all in accord with the wartime alliance with Stalinist Russia. When the U.S. Embassy in Stockholm demanded in August 1942 that he surrender his passport, he declined and it lapsed, which effectively ended his career as a journalist. In Helsinki, the U.S. ambassador to Finland pressed Day to return to the United States. Instead, in late 1942 and early 1943, he wrote the manuscript of the book that I am reading from, which first appeared in 1944 in the Swedish edition. Convinced that Germany was Europe's only bulwark against Soviet tyranny, Day resolved actively to enlist in what he regarded as Europe's decisive struggle for survival. Apologists for America's wartime alliance with the Soviet Union argue that, however distasteful, this alliance was necessary to prevent the victory of Hitler and Third Reich Germany. But given what is now well known about the monstrous character of the Soviet regime, this view is difficult to defend. Scholars now rather widely acknowledge that the victims of Soviet Russia's Stalin vastly outnumbered those of Germany's Hitler. This is laid out in the works of such historians as Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Robert Conquest, or in such studies as the headline-making anthology, The Black Book of Communism. In the summer of 1944, at a time when the tide of war had already shifted decisively to the Allies, he moved to Berlin to work as a broadcaster. Day was not the only American whose voice could be heard on shortwave broadcasts from Berlin. Among other Americans who risked security and even their lives to collaborate with embattled Germany were Douglas Chandler, known to his U.S. listeners as Paul Revere, Fred Kaltenbach, a former contributor to National Geographic magazine, Mildred Gillers, better known as Axis Sally, Robert Best, born in South Carolina and who was the son of a Methodist preacher, who for years had reported from Vienna for the major U.S. news agency in a range of U.S. and British periodicals. There was also Otto Koswitz, a well-regarded scholar who had taught at Columbia University and Hunter College, and Leo Delaney, the Illinois-born son of Irish immigrants. And this foreword was written by Mark Weber in January 2002. And so it goes. It's very, very interesting that these things are now available for us to enjoy. Alrighty, going to page 14 in this book. After the World War, when a great mass migration movement began from Eastern Europe to America, a bitter fight began in the United States to control immigration. The Nordic American realized the danger of being overwhelmed by inferior races. The Jews led the fight against the passage of the immigration law. They organized the other unassimilated minority groups, especially the Slavs, to bring all possible pressure to bear upon the American Congress to defeat the passage of the law. And this is Day speaking. And he says, when I arrived in Europe in January 1921, public opinion in America was just beginning to realize that if America was to remain Nordic, with a Nordic civilization and Nordic ideals, then immigration must be controlled. I began to forward articles and telegrams about the immigration problem immediately to my newspaper. Tens of thousands of applications for American visas were being made every month at the American consulates in Eastern Europe. By far, the largest percentage of the would-be immigrants were Jews. Unknown to the Americans, the Jews in the United States had collected huge funds to assist the Jews of Eastern Europe to reach America. In Riga, for the first time, I came into contact with Jewish journalists. They forwarded news to Jewish newspapers in Germany, France, England, and the United States, and many other countries. Most of their stories concerned pogroms. They obtained them from Jews who had succeeded in bribing their way out of Russia and who were attempting to bribe their way into other countries. I was approached on many occasions and asked to forward pogrom stories. I investigated and found them untrue. The Jewish refugees were seeking sympathy and assistance. With their Oriental imagination and disrespect for the truth, they embellished rumors they had heard in the course of their pilgrimage until they became a real slaughter or a pitiless massacre. These stories were eagerly published by the Jewish press all over the world, who were supporting the collection of funds to enable more and more Jews to reach the United States. I discovered that the two largest American Jewish so-called relief organizations were acting contrary to the law of the United States. They were not so much interested in relief, which was a screen for their illegal activity of actively supporting and financing this mass immigration. They had power and influence enough in Moscow to insert advertisements in the Soviet press which carried the message, and I quote, "Have you a long-lost relative in the United States? Would you not like to go to that country of unlimited opportunities? Then give us the last address you have of your relatives, and we will find them for you and arrange your passage and your visa," unquote. In the United States, the Hebrew Immigrants Aid Society, the HIAS, and the American Joint Distribution Committee, JOINT, collected many millions of dollars, not only from Jews, but also from Christian societies and individuals, ostensibly to aid Jewish war sufferers in Europe. Part of this money was used in actual relief work, but a large amount was placed in a revolving fund from which sums were loaned to immigrants to pay their visas and traveling expenses to America. These loans were repayable over a term of years with a low rate of interest. If the law restricting migration had not been introduced within a short period, the great majority of Jews living in Eastern Europe and Russia would have succeeded in entering America. But this law, which was designed to preserve America as a Nordic country, failed in its purpose. The Jews found means of evading the law. They migrated to the United States in hundreds of thousands, and within the short period of 15 years, the United States, like the Jewish-controlled Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, had become an instrument of Jewish imperialistic ambitions. joint expended tens of millions of dollars to finance Jews starting in business in Eastern Europe after the World War. It assisted in the organization of Jewish banks, cooperatives, factories, and workshops. This flood of American dollars, controlled and directed by joint, and remember, that's the American Joint Distribution Committee, resulted in the Jews obtaining a throttle hold on most branches of trade and industry in Poland, Romania, Lithuania, Latvia, and in other countries. With this financial help, the Jews obtained an advantage over Christian war sufferers who did not receive such assistance from abroad. They forged ahead in business, trade, and industry, and between the years 1920 in 1933, the Jews achieved a dominating economic position in Europe. The activities of these two great international Jewish relief organizations in promoting immigration from Europe to America was illegal according to American law. I kept reporting about this development until the American government was forced to take action. However, Jewish influence in Washington was sufficiently powerful to delay the adoption of countermeasures. It was not until the country at last awoke to the terrible danger embodied in this immigration that an overwhelming wave of public sentiment forced Congress to pass the Johnson Immigration Law. Now, this isn't Lyndon B. Johnson. That came later in 1965. The fight against the passage of the immigration law marked the first appearance of the Jews acting as a national minority in American domestic politics. It was interesting to follow the political activities of the Jews, which were revealed by Jewish newspaper correspondents in New York and Washington, whose articles were published in many Jewish newspapers in Europe. They were also especially active in the campaign to promote mass Jewish migration to America. They reported how Jewish organizations had succeeded in uniting other national groups, including the Poles, Lithuanians, Czechs, Slovaks, Italians, Greeks, Armenians, Ukrainians, and Russians, in pressuring Congress to vote against the law. Jewish newspapers in Eastern Europe proudly reported the growing number of Jews in the United States and their rapidly increasing influence and importance in American political, economic, cultural, and social life. Only a few years after the passage of the immigration law, the Baint, B-A-I-N-T, of Warsaw, apparently that's a newspaper, boasted that the Jewish residents of Washington outnumbered the Negroes living there. I translated many of these articles and telegraphed them back to America. Immediately following the World War, the millions of Jews living in Soviet Russia began to flow across the frontiers. Some remained in the Baltic states and Poland. Others settled in Germany, Czechoslovakia, Austria, France, Romania, and other countries. The great majority attempted to reach America. Rabbis played an important role in this migration of the Jewish people. They provided false documents, such as birth certificates and other identification papers, to Jews born in White Russia and the Ukraine, testifying these people had been born in Latvian, Lithuanian, Polish, and other cities. With these false papers, the Jews, sometimes legally, but very frequently with the aid of bribes, obtained visas to enter these countries and obtained passports. In 1923, the American consulate in Riga had accepted some 80,000 applications from Jews for American visas. Our consulate in Warsaw had more than 350,000 applications. In Europe, more than 1 million Jews had applied for American visas. Every passenger steamer leaving Europe for the United States was crowded largely with Jewish refugees. Shortly before the Johnson Immigration Law, to limit the number of immigrants coming up for vote in Congress, I wrote a letter to Colonel McCormick, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, pointing out the grave danger to America embodied in this Jewish migration. I had already written many articles about the undesirability of these immigrants, I suggested that all correspondents of the Tribune concentrate on writing a series of articles about the immigration problem in an effort to arouse American public sentiment so this law would be passed. My suggestion was adopted, and these articles, published by the Tribune and the 80 other American newspapers subscribing to our service, helped to counteract the pressure and propaganda the Jews had concentrated upon Washington to defeat the law. My series of articles covered the immigration situation in Russia and northeastern Europe. After reporting from Riga and Kovno, I visited Duisburg, Wilna, Grodno, Bielstock, and Warsaw. In an interview, the Polish Minister of the Interior told me that he granted permission to 350,000 Jews to leave Poland and had withheld exit visas from some 180,000 Poles who also wanted to migrate. Explaining his action, he said America was a great country and could assimilate the Polish Jews, and if America would only accept Poland's Jews as immigrants, it would solve one of Poland's most pressing problems. When I asked why exit visas had been refused to many Poles, he said Poland had such a large minority groups, the government had decided to prevent Polish immigration to swell a Polish majority within the country. In my report, I pointed out that if Poland had been unable to assimilate her Jewish population over a period of 500 years, there was little possibility of the United States being able to perform this task. This story, which was also published in a Washington newspaper, caused a sensation, and the very next day, the same Polish minister issued a statement denying that he had ever met me or granted me such an interview. His action did not prevent a protest from being lodged with the Polish government from the American government against Poland's efforts to unload her unwanted Jewish minority in the United States. But the passage of the immigration law, which sought to favor the admittance of the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian nations, did not solve America's immigration problem. The Jews and other unassimilated minority groups in America continued their efforts to annul or amend the law and permit their nationals to enter the United States. My articles assisted in the defeat of the Perlman Amendment, which aimed to grant visas to relatives of families already living in America. I pointed out how the Jews made a specialty of falsifying immigration documents, and if this amendment were passed, it would be discovered that every Jew in Europe had near relatives in America. American immigration restrictions exempt religious leaders. I discovered in the Lithuanian capital, Kaunas, three special rabbi schools. The average person doesn't know that there are two kinds of rabbis, one a religious leader and the other a butcher. These schools were graduating rabbi butchers by the hundreds. Any young Jew could enter and graduate after he had grown his little curls, which dangle before the ears of Orthodox Hebrews, and garbed himself in a long black caftan. Naturally, all rabbi butchers claim to be religious leaders in their application for an American visa. A young American vice consul assisted me in bringing this to the attention of the Lithuanian authorities, who closed these schools. The vice consul was transferred to South America as a result of the Jewish pressure in Washington, and more attacks were made against me by the Jews in the United States. One of the things I noticed traveling about in Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, and other Eastern European countries was that the Jews seemed to completely lack any sense of patriotism or civic spirit. Take an automobile and travel to any one of a half a dozen small towns in a radius of 50 miles of Warsaw. These towns, with between 20 and 50,000 inhabitants, present a terrible picture of poverty, depravity, and squalor. Most of the houses have thatched roofs. If you found one with a tin roof and made inquiries, you would discover that a tin roof had been erected by a Pole who had either returned from America or who had relatives there. In any of these towns, it would be difficult to discover a new building, one erected during the last 20 years. parks, children's playgrounds, an attractive movie house, a modern store, or an up-to-date business establishment simply did not exist. The point is that the majority of the inhabitants of these towns are Jews. They are engaged in business. They bought the produce of the surrounding countryside inhabited by Poles and sold to them the goods they consumed. They had been doing this for 300 or 400 years. They had made money. But where did this money go? It did not remain in these towns to contribute to their development through erection of new buildings, paved streets, canalization, waterworks, or any of the institutions which marked an improvement in the standard of living of the inhabitants. No, the people still drew their water from the town pump. The most modern thing visible in the marketplace is a gasoline pump, which would be tended by a swarthy, bearded Jew in his kaftan, dressed like his ancestors of centuries ago. These sloven, miserable towns portray a poverty as black as the Jew's beard. They do not recommend the Jew as a desirable citizen for any country. Some of the money these Jews acquire, and have acquired in past generations, disappears in immigration. Young Jews have always attempted to avoid military service. Bribes and money were needed to enable them to flee abroad. Some of the money, of course, is hoarded. Some of it goes to pay taxes. But where is the remainder? A day spent in such a town, whether it be in eastern Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, or Romania, develops a better understanding of the Jew. Why he will engage in any dirty business, pander to any vice, commit crimes, in fact, do most anything to keep from returning to such a village and to such a life of cheating and swindling the peasants, dodging payment of taxes, bribing and corrupting his contemptible, paltry way through a depraved and dirty life, a life ordered in this way by his religion, a creed of hate and fear, a belief so hopeless that he is more afraid of death than a believer in any Christian sect, however perverted or fantastic it may be. Perhaps I better offer some proof for the statement the Jews are afraid of death. During the World War, one of my sisters became a nurse in the great King's County Hospital in New York City. One of her assignments there was to care for a ward of 100 beds, which contained old people on the verge of death. The average number of deaths was 6 per day. My sister noticed that, whereas Christians faced death calmly and confidently, the Jews struggle against it and pass from life choking and moaning with terror. She could not understand why the Jews are so afraid to die. Later, when she became better acquainted with their religion, she comprehended. I have also seen Jewish gangsters electrocuted for murder. They do not die like men. They have to be dope before they can be dragged, stumbling with fear, to the little room containing the electric chair. All right, I'm going to go forward to page 63, which is very interesting. Well, the whole book is absolutely interesting. On second thought, I think I'm going to skip the chapter on Poland. I will do it in a later broadcast. And I am going to do chapter 9, which begins on page 101. And this basically talks about the Jews. And okay, on November 18, 1838, the London Times published an article dealing with the settlement of Jewish refugees under the headline, Searching the Atlas. I place this in my archive. That headline is unwittingly anti-Jewish. It reveals just how unpopular the Jews are throughout the world. No nation wanted them as immigrants. No nation was willing to give them homes as refugees. Even England, that great and enthusiastic fighter for the poor and oppressed, did not want them. He's being facetious here. But England did want Jewish capital and Jewish wealth fleeing from Europe before the storm found a ready refuge in London. The Jew made tremendous efforts to expedite their exodus from Europe. Every available avenue was exploited. Every country was approached by Jews secretly and by Christians openly. In 1933, James G. MacDonald, American professor appointed by the League of Nations as High Commissioner for Refugees coming from Europe, toured Europe. Coming from Germany toward Europe, seeking to persuade governments to grant visas to Jews. I met MacDonald in Helsinki and Warsaw, but I was never able to meet him alone. There was always a Jew nearby to listen to the conversation. He accepted the surveillance as a matter of course, as something which went with his salary. He talked much about the fundamental principles of equality before the law and racial tolerance, so painfully won throughout the ages. But he failed in his mission. No country wanted any more Jews, and he was rebuffed everywhere he went. In 1933, he placed the number of exiles at 60,000. This, of course, was an understatement. In Warsaw, I made several attempts to see MacDonald alone. I wanted to discuss the Jewish problem without being overheard by a Jew. I was unsuccessful. The Polish government emphatically refused to consider granting refuge to any more Jews. This decision was both revealing and ironical. It was Poland who had spewed forth most of these Jews into Europe. So, if the Jews were such highly desirable citizens as MacDonald claimed, it would have been no more than natural for Poland to have welcomed them back. Instead, the Poles greeted MacDonald and his mission with indignation rather than pleasure. I learned that ministers he interviewed told him if his search for a home for the unwanted Jewish refugees was successful, he should notify Poland, as they were just as interested as Germany in ridding themselves of their Jews. Other countries adopted the same attitude. In 1932, the World Jewish Zionist Organization held a Congress in Prague. Delegations arrived from all over the world, headed by leaders of world Jewry. I happened to be in Prague at the time and asked permission to attend the meetings. It was granted willingly, and I was given a seat on the speaker's platform. I happened to be the only Christian attending the Congress, and my presence aroused some interest. Rabbi Stephen Wise, American Zionist leader, had come with the New York delegates. Chief Rabbi Professor Dr. Schnorr of Warsaw was also present, together with Rabbi Rubinstein of Vilna and a large delegation of Polish Jews. Rabbis Nurek and Dubin of Riga and many other leaders of Eastern European Jewry were in attendance, and Lord Melchett and his sister accompanied the British contingent from London. Melchett made a speech in English, and apologized to the delegates that he could not address them in Yiddish or Hebrew, but announced that he was learning the ancient language and hoped to address them in their own tongue at their next meeting. For a week, I listened to speeches made in Yiddish, Hebrew, and English. I discovered there were 8 different Zionist parties. They range from the Revisionist Party, whose members were brown shirts and Sam Brown belts, and who proposed to treat the Arabs in Palestine in the same manner the brown shirts had treated the Jews in Germany, to the reddest red Trotsky communists, who are even more left than the followers of Orthodox communism proselytized by Stalin. One evening, the Jewish brown shirts staged a battle with the communists, and after a few minutes of rioting, the Prague police cleared the hall. A few Jews were scratched, but there was no serious casualties. The next day, the Congress convened as though nothing had occurred. Towards the end of the session, a group of Jews approached me and asked if I had sent much news about the deliberations to the Tribune. I replied that I had cabled very little. The reason why I attended was the hope that I could obtain a good story. They asked, "What was this good story?" I said I had heard many great Jewish orators and leaders make speeches in which I explained why the Zionist movement should grow. That Palestine was the only hope for the Jews, since no country wished to permit Jews to enter as immigrants or as refugees. That many countries, through introducing the numerous clauses in universities, were handicapping the Jews in obtaining a higher education. Apparently, this was a prohibition in the universities. That trade and other economic restrictions were making it difficult for the Jews in the fields of business and commerce. That anti-Semitism was growing throughout the world. That the Jews considered themselves disliked, persecuted, and oppressed almost everywhere. These speeches, I told my questioners, reveal that the Jews are unpopular, that their unpopularity is growing, and there was something very radically wrong somewhere. I said, if some really great Jewish leader would arise and ask the Jews to examine themselves to see if they could not find some reason for this dislike, then it would be an important story which I could report. The Jews told me I had been wasting my time. They said no Jew would ever make such a speech or such a suggestion. I replied, this was a matter for regret, and said if the Jews were unable to face squarely the problem of their unpopularity, then the time was coming when the Jews would be in a worse position in Europe than the Negroes were in the United States. At that time, I had no idea my prediction would be so quickly realized. Before continuing this chapter about the Jews, I want to insert here the text of a letter which I wrote to John Czech, that CZECH, sporting editor of the Polish Daily News in Chicago, in January 1938. This letter has an interesting history. I made some copies and mailed them to to a number of friends, both in the United States and Europe, for I thought it might help throw a new light on the worldwide campaign of the Jews to start a new world war and at the same time gain sympathy and popularity for their nation. I mailed one copy to a clergyman friend in America who gave it to Robert Edward Edmondson, formerly of the American Consular Service, who was conducting a campaign to awaken the United States to the peril of Judaism, which, with the aid of the Roosevelt administration in Washington, has obtained a throttle hold on the American nation. Without asking my permission, Edmondson published this letter under the auspices of his organization, the American Vigilante, and circulated many thousands of copies of it in the United States. Here is that letter. Dear John, about the Jews you write, that they are disliked and being openly persecuted can best be attributed to what? The Jew's ethical code is Oriental, and he demands that he be permitted to live according to this Oriental code of ethics in a Christian civilization. For a Jew to cohabit with a Christian girl is not adultery in his code of morals, neither is it against his religion. In fact, a large section of the Jews, in their behavior, seem to consider this a privilege and a duty. A Jewish wife cannot divorce her husband or even complain to the rabbi in case he lives with a Christian woman or girl. The Jews' propensity for doing this is revealed by the nightclubs and other places of entertainment and their attempt to solicit women on the street. This became so open a scandal in many countries in Europe that public feelings were outraged. The Jews are a nation of lawyers and very clever ones. In the welter of new laws and regulations governing business in all countries, they have an advantage over their competitors, the Christian merchants. This advantage is fundamental, for the Christian is brought up to respect the law, while the Cheddar teaches the Jew how to evade Christian laws. It is a tragedy that in most countries of Europe today, trade can only be conducted by paying bribes to government officials, and in the majority of cases, officials will not accept bribes from Christian merchants, but do accept them from Jews. This induced Christians to ask Jews to do the bribing for them. It is demoralizing to all concerned. Jews get more prosperous and acquire Christian mistresses, and so anti-Semitism increases. For many centuries, the chief power of the Jew has been his ability to control and dispose of large sums of money. He is able to get loans and financial aid and credits where Christians are sadly handicapped. The enormous power wielded by the international Jewish bankers stands behind and supports the little Jews, and until now has played a very great role in preserving them from persecution. I think persecution is the wrong word to use. In many cases, it is retaliation from outraged Christians. But now, with all nations balancing their economies, adopting managed currencies, restricting movements of currency and capital, the Jews have lost this important financial power in many countries, and they fear to lose it in others. Remember how it was widely predicted that Germany would not survive because it had no gold? Well, Germany surprised everyone and did survive. If the Jews had had complete world power, they would have smashed Germany long ago. But today their power is waning. They are still powerful and influential in France, England, and America. But even in these countries, anti-Semitism has become more widespread. The next reason for the unpopularity of the Jews, and I consider this one extremely important, is that the Jew is a parasite who has no objection to living on human weakness and failings whenever and wherever he can. All American consuls have a small secret book, I have seen them, containing the names and photos and records of known white slavers and dope traffickers. More than 98% of them are Jews, chiefly Polish, Lithuanian, and Italian Jews. No business is too depraved or dirty for them to engage in. As a police reporter in Chicago and New York, I covered red light districts and found that vice was a Jewish industry. It is the same in Paris and Vienna today. And formerly, the Jews ran the rotten vice rackets in Berlin and other German cities, just as they do in Poland. The Jews formerly held all powerful positions in the press of Europe. I think they must be held chiefly responsible that freedom of the press has been destroyed or limited in practically all European countries. Oriental lack of respect for the truth, the racial inclination to pornography, the fixed belief that they constitute a class above the law, and their attempts to shield and protect other Jews engaged in criminal pursuits have today resulted in a popular outburst of anti-Semitism, of which the anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany is only a small phase. Today, much of Europe considers the Jew as an outlaw, and he has done much to deserve this classification. Of course, it is easy to write an indictment, and it sounds very foolish to attempt to indict a whole people. But really, why have we never heard the great leaders of world Jewry asking, and I quote, "Why is it that today so many nations do not want us as citizens? Why is it that we can no longer immigrate to any country we please? Why is it that we are discriminated against in so many lands? Why is it we are hated and unpopular? Let us examine ourselves and our race thoroughly and try to discover what are those characteristics we have which are the basis for the anti-Semitism growing today." Unquote. Until some really great Jew thus indicts his people and shows them the way to avoid anti-Semitism, then the situation will become worse. I think the only way the Jews can successfully combat anti-Semitism is they must publicly adopt Christian ethics and obey the laws of the Christian communities in which they reside. To hear the Jews blame Hitler and the Nazi government for the persecution of Jews in Germany is ridiculous. Besides, it is not persecution. It is the retaliation of an outraged Christian nation. The Jews should blame Lord Lloyd George and Clemenceau. The Versailles Treaty and the fact that the League of Nations has been largely a Jewish club since it was organized. Versailles, the League, and Bolshevism are mostly responsible for the mushroom growth of nationalism in Europe. Anti-Semitism is spreading rapidly in Europe, and the alarm of the Jews is increasing. It is also swiftly developing in France, England, and America. Because the Jew considers himself above the laws of these lands in which he lives, he has now been placed outside the laws of Germany, Romania, Poland, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Lithuania, and Latvia. For the fact he is an international outlaw, he has chiefly himself to blame. Jews will remain just that until they change their code of Oriental ethics and their manner of behavior. They have no right to appeal to any Christian community for sympathy until they themselves admit their faults. They have no right to appeal for justice so long as they do not respect the law themselves. They have no right to plead for help until they begin to help themselves. The tragedy with most of us is, when we consider the Jewish problem, we forget to think and are swayed by our emotions. If the Jews claim they are being discriminated against and persecuted, then there must be reasons for it. Today, practically every university and college in America has employed one or more Jewish professors and teachers exiled from Germany. They are mostly occupied in the faculties of law and economics. Marx is their great economist. Freud is their moralist, and the Old Testament is their law. Get out your Bible and read the 34th chapter of Genesis, and at the 25th verse, stop and ask yourself if this wasn't a typical dirty Jewish trick. No. If all the Jews went to Palestine, that country would not become the money changer of the world, because the world is beginning to learn that money as a means of service is all right, and as a means of usury is all wrong. The Jews are not nearly so clever as many seem to think. They dig their own pit and fall into it without being pushed. And when they are in it, they shriek for help from the same people for whom they dug the pit. And then they are rescued. And when they are rescued, they begin immediately to dig another. Jewish history reveals wherever the Jews went, they multiplied. And the more they multiplied, the more unpopular they got. Then they were kicked out, and today they lament because the world has become too small to maintain them all in comfort. You will probably wonder why it is that the very great majority of Jews, no matter where they are, sympathize with and do what they can to help the Bolshevik regime in Russia. It is because this regime has been a Jewish racket from the first. The fact that a few Jewish commissars have been liquidated does not alter the fact that Jews control most of the commissars of the Soviet government and have 100% control upon foreign affairs, education, the press, public health, justice, trade, and industry, and are powerful in others. When the Soviet regime falls, there will take place the most awful pogrom in world history. The Jews know this, and that is why they are assimilating themselves in Russia as quickly as they can. The Jews abroad know this, and that is why they help Bolshevism whenever and however they can. They especially try to strengthen the prestige of the Soviet government so that they, the Jews, will be more secure. Poland has a terrific problem in having such a large Jewish minority, and because of this, she deserves much more sympathy and help than she has received up to now. I've studied the Jewish problem for a great many years with an open mind. I have read a great deal of Jewish history and other history. I have talked with several thousand Jews over here about their plight, very frankly, during the past 18 years, asking for their solution. They don't seem to have one. I have asked why some great Jew does not arise and put the question I did at the beginning of this letter. They tell me that no Jew will ever dare ask questions because they contain an attack upon the Jewish religion itself. My conclusions are, anti-Semitism is a perfectly natural historical development. It is going to become more and more general. The establishment of ghetto benches in the Polish universities is a step which has wide sympathy in Europe. This aggregation of Jews will continue to spread, even if they succeed in their aim of promoting a new world war. It will not help to solve the Jewish problem. The Jews will have to do that themselves. The blame cannot be placed on the Germans or anyone else. The Jews are foreign to our civilization, and either they must get out, reform themselves, or destroy that civilization. It seems they are trying to accomplish the latter. Sincere regards from your friend, Donald. On February 21st, 1938, Edmondson published that letter. Fortunately for me, without my signature or the addressee's name, Edmondson was persecuted and denounced in New York as a Jew-baiter, and to preserve himself from physical violence, he moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania. This letter classifies me as an anti-Semite, and when the Jews have made this accusation, I tell them they are wrong, that I have nothing against the Arabs or other Semitic tribes. As this letter mentions, I arrived at these conclusions after studying the Jewish question for many years. This means more than it sounds. A newspaper man comes in contact with more people than the average man in any other professions and callings. His job is to collect news, and this affords an unusual opportunity to study humanity in all walks of life. As a reporter in Chicago, I not only knew many gangsters and other criminals, but also policemen and police officials, lawyers, judges, municipal and federal officials, doctors, businessmen, etc., etc. When a police reporter in Chicago, I was able to write from memory the names of some 1,000 policemen and tell the various precincts where they were stationed. This constituted half the entire police force. There was one reporter who was reputed to know the name of every man on the force. During my 25-year stay in Europe, I have made many fresh friends and acquaintances in many countries. They also come from all walks of life, from the farmer with 40 acres and 5 cows to the president. These cosmopolitan contacts were not confined to one country, for I traveled, worked, and fished in many of them. And on these fishing trips that I came to know and understand the nations of Northeastern Europe a little better, perhaps more than any other correspondent who has attempted to report on these regions. I am mentioning this in order to emphasize that these opinions I have voiced about the Jews are not solely derived from what I may have read and heard, but from actual first-hand experience and contacts. If I have felt uplifted by contacts with fine Jews, I have also felt defiled through contact with Jewish gangsters, revolutionists, and other criminals. Because Municipal Judge Joseph Sabbath was just as kind and considerate as any man could be toward a youthful reporter, I cannot excuse the activities of his brother, Congressman Albert Sabbath, that's S-A-B-A-T-H, who represents one of the Chicago districts in the United States House of Representatives and has done everything in his power to open the doors of the United States to unrestricted Jewish immigration, and who has work to undermine the American immigration law. So, if we are to form an opinion of the Jewish question, which would be fair to ourselves, we must first place our emotions aside, including those fostered or formed by friendships. I know that Judge Sabbath would do everything in his power to aid and protect his brother, the congressman, and for that reason, I must view him as one of the national minority who today are attempting to clinch their present dominating position in American national affairs. If I have to become pessimistic concerning the future of my own country, it is because I have watched for 22 years what the Jewish Bolsheviks were doing with Russia. If the Jews were unable to give Russia an improved standard of living, then how can they improve living conditions in the United States? If they were unable to manage Russia's economic development for the benefit of the inhabitants, then how are they going to manage America's economic development any better? If their rule has proved degenerate and depraved in Russia, then what will it prove in America? If we have converted the nations within Russia into spiritless robots, then what are they going to do with the unassimilated nationals within the United States and with the Americans themselves? If they have succeeded in bringing the United States, a Christian nation, into an alliance with an atheistic, Asiatic despotism devoted to the promulgation of dialectical materialism, then what will happen if these American ideals. For 25 years in Russia, the Jews had a free hand to do as they wished. They erected a system of government founded on terror. They officially defended and sanctioned terror as a means of governing. They sought to excuse their regime, which they officially called the Red Terror, in their press and publications by saying their aim was to achieve a world revolution which would have enthroned the Jews in power all over the world. They found many willing dupes. One of the hidden, sinister Semitic figures in Russia is Artemik Bagratovich Kalatov. That's Khalatov. During the early years of the revolution, he headed the branch of the Cheka, which organized the food supply of the Soviets. He organized the punitive expeditions of the Cheka, which confiscated the grain and foodstuffs from the peasants, a policy whose direct result was the Great Famine of 1920-21. He occupied many posts of importance. Since 1927, he has been the head of the Soviet Publishing Trust and the Communist Censorship. His name rarely appears in Bolshevik publications, although his picture and biography can be found in Soviet encyclopedias. I'm going to stop here. I think the letter was very important. Next time we talk about the selections from this book, I'm going to talk about Poland. As I say, this book is very interesting, very informative, and is a must-read. So thank you so much for joining me today, and I will talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.